lesson for at least 3 weeks, and I have absolutely been unable to fall in love with it. I just can't. I don't know why. It just has been like a slog through mud. And I think it would work better, Troy, unless you have an objection, to present it as a class rather than a sermon. Would that be okay with you? Okay. Thank you. I'm much relieved. So we're going to start out with a little Sunday evening test. I hate to hit this stuff with you when I know you're tired, better than Wednesday night. But these three stories have two things in common. Cain and Seth and the combining of their lineages, Lot and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the story of Dinah and the men of Shechem. Those three stories have at least two things in common for my purpose. What two things do those stories have in common? What's the most obvious thing they have in common? They're all what? They're all, so that's a good start. They're all in the Old Testament. Where are they? Greg, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, aren't they all from Moses?
They're all, so we're narrowing it down. So they're all in the Old Testament, all Moses. Bill, what did you say? But then you backed up on it. Well, first you said they're in Genesis. You said, well, the first one is. So let's drill down on that for a minute, right? What about Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah? Where's that? That's in Genesis. And you know Dinah. Who was Dinah? Whose daughter?
The 13th tribe.
Looks like Cecily has an answer. Cecily, do you want to answer the question? Looks like she had a hand up there. They are all in Genesis. All three of these accounts are in Genesis. And all three of these accounts have the same point. What do you imagine is the point that they all have in common? They're very different stories. They do all involve judgment of a sort.
Bad decisions.
Bad decisions. And what was the bad decision? That's true. There's a particular way, a particular thing that they did that was unwise. They did, but what was it? What did they do that was? Karen, what do you know?
Oh. The first two, there was a death. Someone was killed.
Right, and all three of them, right? All three of them, we have a death. The reason that we have these accounts and what they all have in common is that they are all warnings about associating with the wicked, all three of them, right? So the lineages of Cain and Seth described in chapter 4, which one is wicked? Cain, and Seth is righteous, and then they intermarry in chapter 6, and what's the result? The wickedness of mankind. Lot moves toward and then into where? Sodom, right? And that's destroyed, and he has all that. Troy loses his wife, and then the whole thing. And then Dinah and the men of Shechem, Dinah went to hang out with the women of the land, and then she was sexually assaulted, and then all that trouble with that. All three of those stories are about the dangers of association with the wicked. Who wrote all of them? Who did he write them to? When did he write them? Before they entered Canaan. What was he warning them about? Don't associate with the wicked. And so this warning is, I think, the biggest emphasis in the books of Genesis, Exodus, and Deuteronomy in particular. Three times in the book of Exodus, Moses warns about associating with the wicked. Six times in the book of Deuteronomy, he warns about the same thing. And then in our text, Numbers chapter 33. So if you'd like to turn to Numbers chapter 33, he has a warning about it there as well. So at least 10 times Moses warns the people directly and then includes those three stories Not to mention, remember in the book of Numbers, who is hired to curse Israel? Balaam. Is he able to? No, but remember what he does. When he realizes he's unable to curse them, he sends Midianites into their midst to tempt them with idolatry and sexual immorality. And how does God respond? He destroys a bunch of the people. So there's another warning in the books of Moses. So it's very common. So why do you think that this was such a danger, and why are there so many warnings? Why are there at least going on 15 stories or warnings about the danger of mixing with the Canaanites? Why was it so dangerous? Right, because of the results of it. Why was it so tempting to do it? Why was it such a danger? That's right. The grass always looks greener on the other side, as they say, because you don't have to water it. That's true. Driving them out, so there's a couple of things. Driving them out would be very difficult. Driving out the Canaanites would be very difficult. Imagine if God told us, I want you to march by foot, you can't drive. I want you to march down to the border of South Carolina. So we're all going to have to walk to get our stuff and walk to the border of South Carolina. And then we're going to have to start fighting our way in hand-to-hand combat all the way from the border of South Carolina, all the way up the coast of North Carolina, all the way to the border of Virginia. And you're going to have to fight hand-to-hand combat all the way up, and it's going to take you 7 years to fight all the way from here to here, and you're going to have to conquer all of that land. It's going to take 7 years, and you're going to have to do it by hand. No guns, no tanks, all by fighting with swords and knives and rocks and all that stuff. What would you think about that? Or you could just say, well, I'll just head down to Myrtle, or I'll go out to Shaq and hang out at Shaq and forget all that fighting. Right? This was the temptation that the Israelites faced. You can do all that fighting, and it's going to take you many years of hand-to-hand combat, and many people will die, or you can just mix in with the people of the land and be done. That's pretty tempting, right? The other thing is that following the Canaanites and what they did would have been so easy because what they did was so much fun. Did the Canaanites have the strict rules that the Israelites had? No. Of course not. They were very loose in what they allowed. In fact, the Canaanites, particularly when it came to sexual immorality, which is, you know, in many ways is the biggest downfall in any culture, when it came to sexual immorality, not only did the Canaanites, not only were they allowed to do it, they were encouraged to commit sexual immorality because it made their gods happy and made their crops and animals more fertile. And so the people of Canaan were encouraged to be sexually immoral because their gods enjoyed it and the gods would bless them for it. So defeating the Canaanites would be very difficult, and falling in with the Canaanites would be really easy. And so God has to warn his people constantly. And this is what we see in Numbers chapter 33, 50 to 56. So, if someone would please, would you read Numbers 33, 50 to 56? Numbers 33, 50 to 56.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, opposite Jericho, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their figured stones, and destroy all their molten images, and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land and live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. You shall inherit the land by lot, according
So notice when God is telling his people to eliminate the nations, there are several things that we want to notice. Now, this is a 5-point sermon. I think that's why I couldn't fall in love with it. I think that's the real problem. From now on, I'm not going to do that. But there's 5 things, right? You have to go with the text. You can't force your own preference onto it. The text has 5 points in it, so that's what we're going to look at. So there's 5 things. First of all, whose command, verse 50, whose command is it that they eliminate the Canaanites? It's God's. Then the Lord spoke to Moses. It is, number one, it is a requirement of God. God demands that they eliminate the Canaanites. Verses 51 and 52, when does he demand that they eliminate the Canaanites? When are they supposed to do it? Immediately. Notice he says, when you cross over, then you shall drive them out. Immediately. And then he says, verse 52, how are they to drive them? How much are they to drive them out? What does he say? You shall drive out what? All the inhabitants of the land from before you. Now notice what else he says, right? You shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land, and then, that's not enough, what else are you supposed to do? You cannot, what are their figured stones? What is that? They're idols. What are they supposed to do to them? Put them in museums? Use them as decorations? Destroy them. Destroy their figured stones. How many of them? And then destroy all their molten images, so their idols made of metal, and demolish all their high places. So how thoroughly is this supposed to happen? How much should there be left when they're done? It shouldn't be anything left when they're done. So it's a thorough cleaning. Now, 53 and 54, God is going to tell them to further. So in 53 and 54, he says, take possession of the land and live in it. In other words, I've given you all of the land. I want you to possess all of the land and live in all of the land. This is by taking positive action, acquiring the land, living in the land, working the land, they will further prevent the Canaanites from getting a foothold in it. Right? So, in other words, God says, I'm giving you this land. Don't just take this little part of it and work this little part of it and live in this little part of it, because then what's going to happen in the part you're not occupying? The Canaanites are going to fill back in. So what do they need to do? They need to possess and occupy all of it and live in and work all of it. Positively taking and working the whole thing. And then he says, verses 55 and 56, what should motivate them to do this? Right. He says, I want you to take the long view. So two things. Verse 55. He says, if you don't drive out the inhabitants, then they're going to be a source of suffering for you. Right? If you don't drive them out, if you leave them in the land, they're going to make you suffer. They're going to get under your skin. And eventually, God says in verse 56, eventually, what else is going to happen? Right. He says, I plan to drive them out, but if you don't drive them out, I will drive you out. Right? So God says, take the long view. So these 5 things, I think, apply to us as well in our own dealing with the influence of sin. Remember, whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, our example, that we would learn what to do. So what are we supposed to take from these? Just take a few minutes and apply these things to us and we'll be done. So first of all, it is required by God that we eliminate as much ungodly influence in our lives as possible. This is a requirement of God for us, that we eliminate as much ungodliness as possible. Now, how do we do that? You know, it's sort of like when we have kids. When you first have little kids, you bring kids into your home, right? You have to look at your home from the perspective of a little two-year-old running around, grabbing everything and sticking it in your mouth, right? You have to look at your house that way, right? And so what do? Well, you take out as much dangerous stuff as you can, right? You eliminate as much danger as you can. You can only do so much of that. You can't eliminate all the sharp corners. You can't take all the cleaning supplies out. So what do you have to do? You have to contain that, and you have to work with that as much as you can. You take out as much as you can, and then you manage the rest. The same thing is true spiritually. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, Paul encourages us to eliminate bad influences as much as possible. He said, bad company does what? So what should you do? You should avoid bad company, but is that always possible? Remember, that only goes so far, because in 1 Corinthians 5, 9, and 10, Paul said, I wrote to you not to associate with the immoral people. I did not mean the immoral people of the world, because then you would have to what? You'd have to go live on the moon. You have to associate with immoral people to a degree. But what can you do? You can eliminate as much of that as possible. You don't have to go where they are. You don't have to have, particularly if someone is a bad influence on you. What did Jesus say about your eye and your hand? If it makes you stumble, what? If someone makes you sin, you don't have a choice. What do you have to do? You have to eliminate it. You have to get rid of that relationship. Right? We have to do that as much as possible, but we can only do so much of that. And so turn over to Ephesians chapter 4 and notice what Paul says about living in the world and how we're supposed to manage that. I'm in Ephesians 5. Ephesians chapter 5. Paul talks about managing living in the world. In Ephesians 5 and beginning in verse 3. Ephesians 5 and beginning in verse 3. He says, immorality, impurity, greed must not be named among you as is proper among saints. There must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting. Are those things going to be in the world? Is there going to be immorality? Is there going to be talk that's improper and inappropriate and vile? Right? Is there going to be greed? Yes. But what? But it should not be found where? Right, in the church. And by that I mean in those of us who are members of the church, right? We don't have a problem not having it here. Nobody does it when they come here. But when we go out, it shouldn't be there either. Right? So Paul says, look, you live in the world, there's going to be immorality, there's going to be filthiness, there's going to be inappropriate talk, but it should not be found among you. It should be eliminated among you. He says in verse 7, therefore do not be what? Don't be partakers with them. Are you going to be able to get away from them? Not entirely, but don't what? Don't participate. Don't do what they do. Verse 11, do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. You can't help but be around it to a degree, but what? Don't involve yourself in it. And if you find that it's a big temptation and you're continually falling and falling and falling, then what has to happen? You have to eliminate it. Matthew 5. If your eye or your hand offends you, causes you to sin, then you have to cut it off and throw it from you. So this is something that we have to do. It's required by God. Right? Remember what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 6, 14 through chapter 7 and verse 1. Do not be bound together with who? Unbelievers, right? Do not be bound together with unbelievers, because righteousness, lawlessness, Christ and Belial, darkness and light have nothing in common. So we've got to separate ourselves as much as possible from that. And we have to do it immediately. We have to do it immediately. If there is something, if you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you there is something in your body that is going to kill you if you do not remove it, what are you going to do? Are you going to put it off? You know, when our two of our kids were little, Isaiah and Rhiannon, were both little, they both had this eye condition where they had an eye, the lazy eye, they call it, they had an eye that turned in. And the doctor said with both of them, they need to do something about that. If you don't fix that, it's going to be permanent. It's going to damage their eyesight. They're not ever going to see normally. And so you need to do something about that. What do you imagine we did? Well, we'll get around to it. You know, we don't really have the money right now, and time is tight, and got to go all the way, you know, to wherever, hole up, skull up, and get it done, and all that stuff. So, you know, we'll just wait and see what happens. Are you kidding? There's no way. As soon as you find out something like that, that your kids or you yourself are dealing with, what do? You don't put it off. You get it fixed. Right, if somebody comes into your house and says, well, you got black mold all in your attic and you got it behind your walls and, you know, all that stuff, you don't get rid of that stuff, it's going to kill you. Oh, well, we'll get around to it. We don't do that. But sometimes, spiritually, that's exactly what we do. I know I've got this thing and I shouldn't do that and I shouldn't say that and this person and that thing, and we put it off. But what did God tell the Israelites? When you go in, then you will eliminate them. And that's exactly how it ought to be for us. Paul said in Romans chapter 12 and verse 9, abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. Those are two very strong words, aren't they? What does it mean to abhor something? Yeah, it's a hatred. To abhor something means to absolutely hate it with all that's in you. Do we always do that with things that are wrong? Do I always abhor it? Sometimes we tolerate it. Sometimes we even like it. Sometimes we love it so much, we won't get rid of it. What did Paul say to do with it? Abhor it, hate it, right? Think of something you abhor. Think of something you abhor. I was walking the other day, and I looked down, and there was a snake right in the road. I abhor snakes. I absolutely abhor them. And I got as far away from that thing as I didn't see how close I could get. I didn't try to get close to it and see just how close I could get. I went as far as I possibly could from it. And I mean, it was humongous. It was huge. I bet it was every bit of that long. About as big around as a pencil. No danger whatsoever. Not poisonous. But I got as far away from it as I could. I was not going to get as close as I could. I certainly wasn't going to cling to it. Paul said, abhor what's evil and what? Cling. What does it mean to cling to something? Grab onto it and don't let it go. Do not let it go. And so this is something that has to be taken care of immediately. And it's something that has to be done thoroughly. You know, Paul, since we're in Ephesians, if you're still there, but Paul in Ephesians 22, go ahead and find that for me. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 22, Paul says that becoming a Christian is a full-scale major renovation. It is a major renovation. It's not a minor change. I think a lot of times we look at a person becoming a Christian as sort of a minor kitchen renovation. You know, well, we got to get them wet. That's the first thing. We get them wet. We get them coming to church. Maybe a couple of tweaks here and there, and they're good to go. The Bible doesn't present Christianity that way. Ephesians 4:22. Would somebody read 4:22 to 24, please? So do you see how that's a complete life change? It's such a life change. Look at what he says in 22. What do you do with the old self? You put it away. He doesn't say you become a Christian and then you just do some minor adjustments to what you used to be. What does he say? You have that old self and you take it and you put it over there, and then you do what in verse 24? There's a new self that you replace it with. Do you see how that's an entirely different? This is not taking a house and doing minor renovation. That's not even what Jay does, right? So there's minor renovations, and then there's what Jay does, right? You take a house, you gut it, and then you renovate it. It's not even that. What is Paul picturing? If it were a house, what would it be? It would not be gutting it and renovating. What would it be? It would be scraping it and building a new house. That's how he pictures being a Christian. It is a thorough transformation. Bill?
I give you a good example of what that means, being thorough. You have one rotten potato in a bowl. And if you don't get it out,
got to watch them rotten taters, Bill. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Right? So it corrupts the entire thing. And so when we look at Ephesians chapter 4, if we go on and look at the thoroughness of it in 25, what does he say to do with falsehood? Play around with it? Hang on to some of it? Get as close as you can? What does he say about falsehood?
Lay it aside.
What does he say about anger? Be angry, but what? Sin a little? Don't sin. Look at what he says in verse 28. If you've been stealing, steal less. Steal what? What does he say in verse 29 about unwholesome words? Don't use quite so many. Just clean it up a little. You can still throw one in every now and then. If you whack your thumb with a hammer, of course you're going to let one go, and that's okay. What does he say? Let what? No unwholesome word proceed from your mouth. Verse 31, how much bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, slander, and malice did you get rid of? How much of it? All of it. It's a thorough life change. Completely life change. Total makeover when we become a Christian. And then notice the positive action. So again, what he tells them is this. Go into the land. So there's two parts to this. Go into the land, eliminate the Canaanites, and then what? Possess the land, dwell in it, all of it, and live in the whole thing, and positively impact and build and live in all that land. Okay, so notice the two parts. Drive out the bad, and then what? Do the good. Drive out the bad, do the good. Look at what Jesus says about this in Matthew 12. Jesus talks about this in Matthew 12 very graphically. Matthew 12 is talking about Jesus casting out demons. And in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus says, makes this point. He's talking specifically about a person who has had demons in them and they've been cast out. But this is the principle is true in any case. Verse 43, Matthew 12. So the demon has been cast out, the unclean spirit. When the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places seeking rest but doesn't find it. So the demon's looking for another place to live. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. What is the house? It's the person who it was cast out of. When it comes, it finds it, and here's the key word, it finds it what? Empty or unoccupied. Now, who used to live in there? The demon did. Now it's unoccupied, swept and put in order. Then it goes and takes along with it what? Seven other spirits, more wicked than itself. And they go in and live there. And the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. Notice that the man from whom the demon was cast out is unoccupied. He took care of the bad, or Jesus did, took care of the bad. What did the man not do? He did not replace it with good. Right? It's not enough to eliminate, if you eliminate junk food from your diet, but you don't replace it with anything, you're going to get hungry, and what are you going to eat? junk food, right? You can eliminate screen binging, right? Whether your phone or your tablet or your TV, your laptop, whatever it is. You can eliminate binging on screens. You say, I'm not going to do that anymore. Used to spend 5 hours on screens. I'm not going to do that anymore. So you're going to sit around twiddling your thumbs. So what are you going to go back to? You're going to go back to screens again. If you don't what? If you don't replace it with something positive. And so this is what he's telling them. Go in and replace the bad with the good. Now, this is a great way to eliminate sin in our lives, is by replacing what we used to do, the things that we used to take and do wrong, and use them to do right. The time that you spent doing something you shouldn't should now be used for what? Do something good. The money that you spent, the effort that you spent, use it to do something positive. All right, so we'll begin to wrap up. Let me just mention this. Starting next Sunday night, we're going to have a new Bible study. So next Sunday night will be a class as well. And it's going to be a new study on the second coming. It's going to be centered in 1 Thessalonians 4 and 5. But we'll go back and look, because one of the main themes of 1 Thessalonians and 2 is the second coming. And so we'll look at an overview of the second coming in the Thessalonian letters, and then we'll get in depth into the second coming in the passage that I have there. This coming Wednesday, we're going to look at evidences of Jesus. Is there any evidence of Jesus outside the Bible? There is. We'll talk about what it is. But for now, we'll finish up by looking at this last point. And that is, eliminate sin by keeping the long view in mind. Eliminate sin by keeping the long view in mind. There's only one way that sin can really trick you into committing it. Sin really only has one benefit, really only one, and that is that it's pleasurable right now. That's really all sin has going for it. The only thing sin has going for it is that in this moment, when I do it, I'm going to enjoy it. That's all it has. It has nothing else beyond that. But that's a powerful thing, isn't it? Delayed gratification, the denial of present enjoyment, is obviously very enticing because we give into it all the time. We do it a lot. But that's all that sin has going for it. What he tells them in Numbers 33 is to take the long view. He says, if you do not eliminate the Canaanites, in the short term, they will cause you suffering. So watch how this applies. In the short term, they will cause you suffering. In the long term, they'll be the end of you. Do you see the parallel to sin? Sin is pleasurable in the moment. But in the short term, in life, it becomes a real burden. It really brings suffering. Now, we think that it's not going to do that for us. We think we're going to be the exception, that we'll commit it, we'll get away with it. We never do. In the shorter term, it's going to cause suffering. In the long term, remember what Jesus said in Matthew 5, if your right hand or your right eye offends you, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to enter life maimed than to what? Enter hell whole. So what Jesus says is, take the long view when it comes to sin. It's better to eliminate sin, even if it hurts now, than to face an eternity of punishment because you did not eliminate it. Taking the long view is very important. So Jay, is going to have our invitation song in just a moment. Jay, what was it again? I'm sorry. Bill, I'm sorry. Bill, go ahead and then we'll get that.
I got one question.
Yes, please. Yeah, that's an excellent question that I don't really have much of a good answer to. The question is, God, they're going to go in. Is God, if they're faithful, is God going to completely spare them? My feeling about that is no. That in anything like that, there would be loss of life. And I think the same is true with us, right? Even when we're doing the will of God, we're going to suffer losses. We're going to suffer in some sort of way. So I think either way there would have been some of that, but that's a really good question and an interesting thing to think about. I appreciate you asking that. So Jay, our invitation song, sorry.
816.
Number 816, we'll sing that in just a moment. So what we talked about tonight is really important. I believe it's the most important message that Moses ever tried to get across to the Israelites. They were going in to be exposed to a culture that was completely wicked, completely godless, and the danger was that they would be tempted by it, give into it, and be destroyed. That's exactly where we find ourselves today. We've never lived. Tracy and I were watching, or Tracy was watching TV today. I was working, but kind of seeing what was going on TV. But Tracy was watching TV today, and every single commercial that came on was some sort of ungodly portrayal of something. It was one thing after the next. Just on the commercial. It's not even the show. And the culture that we live in is obsessed with promoting the worst forms of ungodliness. It's like the next person tries to top the last person for outrageous wickedness. That's what we live in. And it's very difficult to not give in to that. And so this is the message that Moses is giving the Israelites. So if you find that that's something that you're struggling with, we can help you with that. Or there's some other issue that you have that you're struggling with, we want to help however we can. So we'd love to speak privately after church, or you can come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing.